Okay, let's make a start, please. I just a note that there will be seminars this week, starting 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock tomorrow. Everybody have a seminar that you've been assigned to? Okay. I'm trying to tape the lecture today, and if it works, I'll upload it later this afternoon. And if not, I'll continue with my inquiries. So perhaps the central theme that runs through all of the readings we're going to do this term is that of modernity. What do we mean when we use this word, when we speak of a culture or a society as modern? Is there a modern way of thinking or of doing things? Is there a modern condition? If so, what are its attributes? Is everybody in the world today modern? Or are only some of us modern? And look at a couple of clips here. The Pudong skyline from the Bund in Shanghai. So something like a paradigmatically modern landscape or scape, and the question would be then, what is the relationship of that to the concept of modernity? Also, if you think, for instance, of China as a late-breaking entrant, if that's how you think of it, to the modern, how does the Pudong skyline impact on New York? Is New York still modern, or is New York kind of receded in modernity in some sense? Have a look at the way in which this debate is also played out elsewhere. Here, this is obviously not my subtitle, but from the... I can't remember where I took it from. Primitive people, Santa Cruz, Solomon Islands, Melanesia, Oceania. And we notice some features about this, some aspects of what they're wearing and doing, which seem to be very old, some not so old, and yet always primitive. So the sandals, for instance, which are contemporary sandals, but that doesn't obviously qualify these people as modern in the views of this writer. But then other questions, what is the relationship between modernity or the modern and wealth, for instance, or poverty? This is a shanty in Port-au-Prince in Haiti. Is this modern? How do we understand this? I mean, in some ways, of course, you would argue that this is precisely the face of modernity. If you put Pudong alongside this, both are co-present in the now, in some sense. And you might argue that the two are actually mutually entailing. Here, just a sort of fact sheet: who are Haiti's poor rural people, and where are they? Poorest groups. Think about these categories in relationship to the concept of the modern. So, women who are heads of households. Do women have a specific relationship then to the modern, namely that they are the ones left behind, rural workers. So the modern would begin to be defined perhaps, if all of these things are the opposite of the modern in some way, in the way we think about that category, fishers who don't have their own boats, charcoal producers who have no other activity, etc. So in which case, so what are those of us then who are not modern? If we see only some of us as being modern in the world. Is modernity to be understood as a kind of leading edge? So some of us are already modern. Whoever we are, have been modern for centuries. But all of us are then destined to become modern. Modernity is then understood as a kind of a gradually extending social logic or something like this, so that the future of us all is to be enveloped within the modern in some sense. So that modernity as a sort of social logic or a tendency whose unfolding or development seems inexorable. You can't resist modernity. But then when does modernity begin? What are its causes? Or determinants, and where does it begin, and why? What ought we then to make of the claims to post-modernity when you start using that language of the poet? It's as though you've eclipsed the modern and have become post-modern. Some of us have left even modernity or the modern world behind. So some of us then, on this logic, of some of us are in the post, as it were, postmoderns. Others are moderns, or perhaps mere moderns. We've left those behind. And some of us are not yet moderns, or pre-moderns, and also, therefore, by definition, pre-postmodern, if you go in that direction. So is modernity a historical category? Do we say that there was a pre-modern, is this a historical term for us? Is it a geographical category? Of course, it could be all these things at the same time. The relationship between the modern and the West, think about that relationship for a moment, that we often, I've always been struck by the fact that maps that think in this way often paint Japan, for instance, or Australia as modern, although they, of course, not in the West. In Australia, they refer to themselves as a Western people. If you look at any kind of map, there's no way that makes sense, obviously. Is modernity, though, if it's not geographical and it's not historical, is it some kind of experiential condition? Is it a way of thinking or feeling? Is it some sort of existential condition, some way that you you think about things? Here's Leah Periovsky's fabulous drawing, Modernity, and we see her playing here. This is an artist who grew up in what was then Yugoslavia, but post after the end of communism, which is viewed by, it's the advent for people from Slovenia, let's say, Croatia, Serbia, Montenegro, often thought of as being, obviously their advent into capitalism. Is that also understood as an advent into modernity? And it's interesting that she spirals off from the category of modernity in the very center there. Everything else is governed by that perfect society, etc., and various other sorts of categories that she's playing with. All of her work plays with these kinds of categories. You see in the literature quite often descriptions of, this extraordinary moral sensibility and modernity, as though obviously those people who identify themselves as modern are also able to legislate which are the most moral societies in the world, and those are the ones obviously in the dark blue Western, it's said. Of course, there's Australia, Western, but Europe, so that in other words, as though modernity gives you a certain kind of moral supremacy, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, languishes far behind. And as for the Maghreb and the Mashriq, of course, those are defined quite radically in opposition to this idea of a moral sensibility. This was one, perhaps my favorite slide that I found this week. Why pan-Islamism is the biggest roadblock for Muslims' integration with modernity. It turns out that being Muslim, or thinking about pan-Islamism, thinking in terms of the category of the ummah, in other words, Muslim people of the world, thinking in terms of that category places you in opposition to modernity. So what exactly is modernity on this definition of it? You can see how fantastically political, polemical, ideological this definition of modernity is here. Just take that on board. Let me introduce, if I can, a three-part schema for thinking through some of these categories. We're going to come back over and over again this term to some of these discussions. So let me distinguish, if I can, between modernity, one category, modernization, another, and modernism. Three categories there. Modernization, usually spelled by the Americans at least with a Z, of course, modernization. And what we're asking here is, what are these three, as it were, and what's their relationship? What's the relationship of modernism to these other categories? So very briefly, let me just say that I'm trying to use images here to describe. Modernization is usually taken as referring to an updating of technological forces of production. So the plant, for instance, the move from factory labour to various kinds of integrated and computerised, these things where it's the technological resources that have changed. This is always described as modernising. A modernising economy is one that seizes the opportunity to upgrade its plant or the various kinds of technological forces within its compass. Interestingly, of course, if you're talking about upgrading plant, so that making things more efficient, the corollary question of the social relations of production tends to get forgotten. What kind of class relations, what kind of gender relations are entailed in modernization? Or are those irrelevant? If you say something about, we used to have Fleet Street, for instance, and journalists would work in a certain way, but then around about the 70s or 80s, it became possible to produce newspapers in a much more modernized way. But what happened to the employment contracts of journalists at this time? And of course, under the rubric of modernization, that's never taken into account. So that the laying off of dozens, hundreds of journalists, or the effects of modernization on employment, on class relations, on gender relations, are usually not considered under the sign of modernization. But if you're thinking that we're moving towards a world, if this is how the modernizers like to see it, a world, a fully automated world, does that mean also a world in which work is unavailable to people? We might think more differently about modernization if we thought about it in those terms. The next term, which would be that of modernism, is quite easy to define. Modernism is very obviously a cultural movement, a form of cultural expression. Probably we could date it with some difficulty. Take 1848 as one kind of. I'm going to mention that because, of course, of the revolutions in France and so on. But if you think about the tremendous changes in the world of cultural expression, late 1870s, as the city begins to become the dominant province of cultural expression, as new forms of impressionism and then expressionism are developed. So we all know in some sense what modernism is. When we say modernism in literature, in English, we usually mean people like Joyce or Yeats or Pound. Think of Pound's slogan, "Make it new." That's the great slogan of modernism. Making it new always seems to mean, seize every new thing that comes about and think about it through. So newness in relationship to an older idea of tradition, for instance, begins to be quite privileged here. If you'd said "make it new" to a 14th or a 16th century painter, for instance, they would have said, "Why?" The whole purpose is not to make it new, but in fact to be good. That is to say, to model yourself on the masters, on the classic tradition. But this idea of making it new. So we can begin to see that there may be a relationship between modernism and modernization in some sense. And if you think about some artists in the 20th century, I'm thinking of the vorticists, for instance, Wyndham Lewis, or alternatively of the futurists, most particularly in Italy and elsewhere, where they actively celebrated the new technological forces, the airplane, the megaton bomb, particularly, and many of the futurists, Marinetti and others, were fascists. So they loved the idea of this new weaponry. This was the new world. A new kind of human was entered into the scene, and they tried to depict this in their work. The third category then would be modernity, and modernity then is perhaps, if you think modernization, modernism, is modernity in some ways to be understood as the atmosphere of the modern. This is how Marshall Berman describes it in his wonderful book, well worth looking at. We'll refer to it a couple of times over the course of this term, "All That Is Solid Melts Into Air," subtitled "The Experience of Modernity." And he, there's this paradox that he draws our attention to here. Of to be modern, he says, is to find ourselves in an environment that promises us adventure, power, joy, growth, transformation of ourselves and the world. So the sense of the tremendous unlocking of resources, of human possibilities, tremendously closely connected, that in some sense the harnessing or the mastering of nature, the ability to extract fossil fuels and so on and so forth, deeply connected with this idea of human emancipation in some sense. But at the same time, it seems as though you can't have that without the corollary, the opposite. At the same time, it threatens to destroy everything we have, everything we know, everything we are. I suppose the clearest example of this for us today would be climate change. Climate change is caused precisely by the first part of that, the development of new productive forces. But it turns out that there's this tremendous downside, a negative side to it, so that you can't have the one without the other, and you can't turn back either. That's how Berman introduces these categories. So Michel Foucault says that Immanuel Kant's short essay that we've read for today, he says it represents a turning point in the history of philosophy. In the history of thought, he says more generally. And it's an interesting argument. This little text, he says, is located in a sense at the crossroads of critical reflection. It's a reflection by Kant on the contemporary status of his own enterprise. It isn't the first time that a philosopher has given his reasons for undertaking his work at a particular moment. Many times before, philosophers have said, look, things have changed, a king and emperor has died, or alternatively, there's been a war, or I've travelled somewhere. I now need to explain to you why I'm saying these things. But it seems to me, says Foucault, that this is the first time a philosopher has connected in this way, closely and from the inside, the significance of his work with respect to knowledge, that is to say, the epistemological status of his work, a reflection on history, so these ideas, this time, and a particular analysis of the specific moment at which he's writing. It's that last thing that Foucault wants to put particular emphasis on. A reflection on today as difference in history. It's a deceptively easy idea to think through, but to think it all the way through is quite complicated. Today as difference in history. If you think again of the very idea of tradition, that notion of same as it ever was, is the notion. Today not as a difference with respect to the past. But within modernity, it would seem, on the contrary, every moment becomes this crisis-ridden break with the past. That's what's being suggested here. And it's Kant's kind of awareness of this. It's not explicitly thematized in Kant. But Foucault says it's there underlying his work. We can see it in his work, the sense that, that we stand on the kind of threshold of some tremendous change. That's why Foucault is so interested in this little essay, as he puts it. I'm going to play you a music video now that it seems to me we can read as a sustained and complicated and very clever reflection on the idea of modernity, what's at stake in this idea. So it's from this album by the Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime. Remain in Light is the album. The song that I want to play is Once in a Lifetime. Track first released in 1980. And it's the title itself, of course, Remain in Light, is already a reflection on the concept of enlightenment. Remain in light, the emergence into the light, out of the dark. If you think of how within Enlightenment thought, you think about superstition as the dark past, the Middle Ages as the Dark Ages, for instance. Light, dark, tremendously powerful metaphor for thinking about modernity. So if I can get this to work. Thank you. there's a lot you could say about that. I mean, I noticed some of the features. Notice firstly the dress. So the very formal attire. In fact, as a way perhaps of marking his own status, presence in the now, but also as a way perhaps of inuring himself against the threat of difference. But also then the throughout the video, those huge shocks that he's up to, as he's saying things and gets blasted backwards. We'll come across this particularly when we read Volta Benjamin, where Benjamin is arguing that basically if you think about the change from the 1880s to the 1920s, say, of what it's like to live in a city, that in some sense you can't go forward, you can't venture forth in a city unless you have developed a certain kind of carapace or a certain kind of armor that lets you anesthetize yourself against the shock of the new. That sense of, you know, what it's like when you first arrive in a huge city if you've come from the country. The cars whizzing everywhere. The way in which the present bombards you with stimuli, which, Benjamin is playing with this idea of aesthetics and anesthetics. So somehow you need to develop an anesthetic. We need to anesthetize ourselves, he suggests. And I think that David Byrne here was exploring that idea of the shocks, which undermine the certainty or the desired presentation of himself as solid, as grounded, as a man of substance, etc. Constantly being shocked, we see these images of other societies which are not understood, whose rituals and customs seem somehow to infect his own gestures as he starts doing this without any understanding, as it were, bowing down again without understanding. That sense of the relationship. If modernity is not a smooth thing, modernity is marked by unevenness in some ways, but unevenness then recurs in the psyche of the present as a kind of unconscious which erupts in some way. I mention these terms because, of course, Freud writes at precisely the moment of this tremendous change. And isn't Freud registering in some way the shock of the new as well? So these are the lyrics of the song. So Kant, I would say, is the first person, if we're reading Kant in Foucauldian terms, Kant is the first person to ask the questions, how did I get here? How do I work this? Or if we rephrase those questions in terms of the three questions that Kant said that philosophy ought to be interested in, what is philosophy for Kant? And the three questions that he says, what can I know? What should I do? And what may I hope? Those are the three questions. And those are fundamentally modern questions, is the suggestion that I'm making here. These are aspects, obviously, of the same bigger question, who are we, what is a human being, etc. And is our understanding of who we are different in modernity from the way in which it might have been at other times for other people, assuming we could speak of other people or other times as in terms of this category of modernity? For Foucault, Kant is the first thinker to bring the question of the now to the table philosophically. In discussing Kant, he goes on to distinguish between two conceptions of modernity, and we'll look at these in seminar tomorrow. So he says there are two dominant conceptions. One is modernity as a period, a time, and the other is as an attitude. And he favors the second, of course. So we'll explore that distinction later on in the module, but also tomorrow we'll start. Look at this formulation also by Jürgen Habermas, whose work we'll be reading next week, but not this particular essay. And he says that Kant is the first philosopher to take aim like an archer at the heart of a present that's concentrated in the significance of the now, the contemporary moment. And thereby he inaugurates, says Habermas, the philosophical discourse of modernity. It's precisely that idea of the present as concentrated in the now. The now is a break from what it was. The now is a break between the break between today and yesterday, as a leap, as a crisis, as a rupture, It's that notion for Habermas that inaugurates the philosophical discourse of modernity. All modern philosophers are aware of that distinction. In thinking, that's fundamental to modern thinking, says Habermas. And I think, although he and Foucault agree on very little else, they agree on this notion, and they find it, both of them find it in Kant's little essay. So the essay we're reading, the Kant essay, was his entry to a competition which was run by the Berliner Monatschrift, the Berlin Monthly, which was a journal of ideas or opinion with a fairly wide non-specialist readership. It wasn't it's a little essay, it was meant for wide readership. It's not a philosophical essay. It's not meant to be read by philosophers only. It's the kind of thing that you would read in a kind of an op-ed or in any kind of, say, the London Review of Books or something like that. In April 1783, one of the editors of the journal published a proposal, and the proposal was that we should not engage the clergy any longer when marriages are conducted. It's a fairly radical proposal in 1783, that the church should have nothing to do with marriage. And that was the proposal. And of course, the moment that the Monatschrift, the monthly, put this out, there was tremendous kind of controversy, particularly, as you can imagine, bishops, priests, men of the church, men of the state, wrote in and said, outrageous, how dare you say such a thing, etc., etc. But then others got involved on the other side and said, what a great idea. And the Berliner Monatschrift decided to have a competition. And they came up with the idea, rather than just that particular issue, what they said was, they invited some pretty famous people. Kant was a professor of philosophy at the university. Moses Mendelssohn, the famous 18th century Jewish German philosopher, also entered the competition, but Kant won it, actually. And the competition was, write an essay on the topic, what is enlightenment? And we're reading Kant's entry then. Quite a few of the leading lights then contributed. So Kant's essay, as I said, was published in November 1784. Such an interesting date, of course. The date, it's 8 years after the American Revolution, it's 5 years before the French Revolution. We could say that stuff, ideas, are happening. A time of tremendous intellectual and political ferment. So the argument rests on this opposition between public and private reason, and we'll probably begin seminars tomorrow by discussing that opposition, because the way Kant talks about it, it's kind of counterintuitive. When he says private, he doesn't mean what we mean by the word private. We mean by private reserved for me, as it were, and something that is mine, or something, you know, that comes from the inside, interior, domestic, and so on. That's not at all what Kant means by the word private. In fact, I think that when Kant uses the word private, you should imagine the word corporate. That's what he thinks. The army figure, it's the one we still have the term the private in the army. And that's the one residue, if you like, of this use of the word, as Kant understands it. The private, by definition, is the least private person. He's always available. He's always visible. You can see him. You can order him around. And moreover, the private must act corporately. In order for the army to function, there must be hundreds of privates doing what they're supposed to do, like a cog in a machine. Is how Foucault describes it. That's private reason. So when we are thinking the thoughts appropriate to us as cogs in a particular machine, so that, in other words, if you're a preacher, what are the thoughts appropriate to you? Well, they're those that your office, in a sense, would bestow on you, and that you would expect, you know, a priest to have certain kinds of views. About God, for instance, about the sanctity of marriage, and so on and so forth. That's private reason. It gets a little more complicated, this, obviously, when we're talking about what we're doing in this room right now. Because I'm a university lecturer, the university is a corporation like none other that we've ever known, and so on and so forth. So that I am acting like a cog in which I'm performing my allotted, this is the role that I get paid to do, and I am doing it. I'm thinking privately, etc., etc. But perhaps this is as it were the exception that proves the rule. Perhaps private thought can break away from privacy or from privateness. But mostly private thought doesn't break away from privateness. Mostly private thought stays within its particular sphere. Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, the famous formula. And that's private thought. The state is entitled to levy taxation. You pay your taxes, and that's private reason. You might, of course, hate the system of taxation. You might write things about it elsewhere. That's not private reason. But as a citizen, you have to pay, and you have to act in a certain way. So we can look at that different theta. Notice also that there's this private-public distinction in the essay, but there's another distinction that you could speak about, and that's between the particular and the universal. It's strange in the essay. On the one hand, the question that Kant wants us to consider, what is enlightenment, is universalistic in conception. He doesn't say, what's enlightenment for you lot over there? What is enlightenment is a general question. It's a universal question. His essay then is full of references to man or to mankind, meaning humanity at large. On the one hand, then, the essay is marked by that universalistic conception. On the other hand, it's explicitly marked by the specificity of its location and the particularity of its historical moment. It's insistently, you could say, emphatically signed off. Königsberg in Prussia, 30th of September, 1784. So place and time in the essay are not universal or general, but they're singular. So one of the first things we might want to ask then is there any sort of connection between this particular, Königsberg in Prussia, 1784, and the universal mankind, humanity in general? So we can put the question in Kantian terms again. This is how Kant tends to rephrase these questions. We have to ask ourselves, what are the conditions of possibility of an answer to the question, what is enlightenment? What has to be in place for that question to be answered? For that question to be answered in the way that Kant answers it? Is there a suggestion that the question couldn't be asked or couldn't be answered in the same way somewhere else? Let me show you, for instance, where does anyone know where Königsberg is, by the way, or what it is now? So here's a political map of the 18th century, and here you'll notice Germany doesn't exist, of course. Italy doesn't exist either, and so Poland is a kingdom. But here up in the, just above, between, well, above Cologne and Hanover, over to the northwest, is that small green place. It's there that Königsberg is. Scroll forward to our own time, and you find this anomaly in the map. I don't know how many of you are aware of the kind of anomaly. If you look at Russia, here in the east, go across Belarus, Lithuania, and Latvia, and you find a strange non-contiguous bit of Russia. The moment you see that, you think, my God, there must be a history there, obviously, and there is. But it's within that small sector of Russia, directly above Poland, that Kaliningrad, or Königsberg, is. That was one of the central cities of the Kingdom of Prussia, in fact, Kingdom of North Prussia, which is where Kant was a professor at that time. So that sense of Prussia no longer exists on our maps at all, obviously. So how exactly does Kant figure and represent the enlightened absolutism of Frederick the Great in his essay? Could one who is the emperor, to whom he has to submit every Monday or every Friday, I forget the day of the week, Everything written in the Kingdom of Prussia had to be submitted to the official state censor once a week and vetted for publication. So you see private and public already coming into being. There are things that Kant didn't want to risk writing and so on. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how Kant says, you know, of course, you know, he's full of praise in the essay for the Emperor Frederick. Could he have answered or asked the question the same way in the Paris of 1784, 5 years before the revolution, or of the United States, or Boston, let's say, in 1784, 8 years after? What about in Cairo, or Calcutta, or Shanghai, or Istanbul? Could that question have been asked in 1784? And how might it have been answered? So we begin to speculate then that thought and politics are quite closely connected, and the shapes of particular theories are in some sense a function of the time and place in which they emerge. There was an interesting debate in the 1780s in German universities, which I won't go into in any detail here, between the higher and the lower faculties. Basically, there were two sets of faculties, and the lower faculty, which was where philosophy was located, the higher faculties, law, medicine, jurisprudence, and so on, and they were understood as being, I mean, higher and lower were just they were in terms of better or worse or more or less resourced. But in Kant's view, the higher faculties, so law, medicine, etc., statecraft in some way, were more instrumental. They taught you how to do stuff, which you would then go off and do. How do you become a lawyer? Well, you learn these, you know, you learn the history of canon law. You go off and then, and theology also was one of those. You go off, you train as a priest, and you go off and practice as a priest. So that the kind of knowledge produced in those faculties was instrumental. It was goal-directed. The kind of knowledge produced in the lower faculties, of which philosophy was the most important, was different, Kant argued. Of course, we can be skeptical about this. He would say that, wouldn't he, being a philosopher? So keep that in mind for a moment. But he argues that what happens in the lower faculties is, as he puts it, thinking for thinking's sake. Your ideas take you where they go. Thinking freely begins to emerge as something that happens in the lower faculties. You may be training to be a writer or an intellectual or an academic, but there's no particular way in which you have to do that. You don't have to interpret a certain set of symptoms as mumps if you're a writer. So thinking for thinking's sake is open-ended, but also thinking for thinking's sake is public-directed. Thinking for thinking's sake always has in mind the idea of somebody out there who's listening to you and judging you. So you always have in mind that you're addressing an audience. An audience always seems to be, it's strange, that audience always seems to be present in the mind of the thinker, because you're trying to persuade. If you move across for a moment to think, it's precisely at this time, of course, the novel is coming into being as a genre. And think of what it's like to be a novelist in the way which was not true, for instance, for a court poet or something. Austin thinks of this, obviously Fielding does so, and Richardson even more so. It's the sense of you're writing for a readership out there. You don't know who they are. You don't know their tastes. They're not friends of yours. It's anonymous, this particular thing. So you have to appeal in some way to the court of public opinion, in a sense. That's what thinking for thinking's sake has to do, according to Kant. And this Kant writes a famous book, I can't remember the year, about 1790, I think, called The Contest of the Faculties. A short book, it's well worth reading, it's in the library if you're interested, where he talks about the conflict between these two faculties in the university. So Kant opens then with this idea of immaturity, and let me just say something about this notion. The German word he used here, Unmündigkeit, So if you break this down, we see that it's a negative. So as in English too, immaturity, whose opposite is maturity. But mündigkeit, meaning majority perhaps, the etymological root is the word mund, a mouth. So it's the ability to speak for yourself, which means to represent yourself before others. And if we think how this comes into play, obviously, in law, children have no mündigkeit. Children are not allowed to speak for themselves in the law. They're always their parents' speak for them. Women, noticeably, are unmündig at this point. Women are not allowed to represent themselves. So one of the reasons that it was impossible ever, for instance, to obtain rape convictions in the 19th century was that a woman's voice was officially declared to be, I can't remember, depending on the various state, a third, a quarter, a half of a man's. So unless you had, say, five women who had the same experience of rape, they couldn't outweigh the man's denial. So women were unmündig in this time. So non-age, minority, also, of course, non-compos mentis, not of sound mind. So that sense of with representativeness comes responsibility, also the need to speak. Then the mouth. So the condition of immaturity is defined by Kant as the inability to use one's own understanding without the guidance of another. I've been emphasizing not only the inability, but the enforced inability, the impossibility, legal impossibility of using your voice. So what causes this inability? Kant says ignorance, simple lack of knowledge, one obvious answer. He says also that increasingly we're living in a world in which there is a social division of labor, so that none of us is able actually to do the things, to take responsibility for the whole of our lives. We're obliged to give over large sections of our life to experts. Thus, in a sense, choosing our own immaturity, he suggests. But above all, he says, lack of resolution to use one's understanding. And here he plays on the idea that I mentioned last week from Horace, sapere aude, dare to know. The insistence on knowing and on having a voice. You can see that this is an incipiently or implicitly political idea in the 1780s. The demand that you have a voice and that it be heard by the public, in the public sphere, on the public stage. Even if what you're having a voice about is not necessarily a political thing. Of course, there were debates raging about the morality of slavery and so on. And Kant was terrible on this. But there are other things. Should you be able to get married without the church? This is not, you say it's not kind of immediately political. Of course, it is political too. But informed people who take responsibility, people who can represent themselves, have views about this. And they put it out there. And the views are actually then have to be taken into account in some sense by the state, even if at the head of the state is a despot, Frederick II, an emperor, who's actually not legally obliged to listen to anything at all. I mean, he could have Kant and those like him thrown in prison if he wants. But because he defines himself as a man of culture, an enlightened despot, Frederick's in this peculiar position. He enjoys the prestige that comes to him because people like Kant are speaking freely. But he thinks that people like Kant are actually quite dangerous also and need to be kept in check. And you can see that there would be all sorts of tensions around there. So with regard to the individual, liberation from self-incurred tutelage denotes a subjective maxim, namely dare to think for oneself. Kant says that it's necessary to think against dogmas and formulas and authoritarian ideas in whichever arena they arise, in politics or in religion or at the level of common sense. So for instance, if you say something like men are naturally the heads of households. They're the rational ones. etc., etc., these ideas which were very kind of common ideas. If you're thinking merely to think, you are potentially open to rebuttal. For instance, if a woman were ever to gain access to the public sphere, to write in the Berliner Monatsschrift, to write for an anonymous audience, she could say, I've never heard such rubbish in my life. You know, just look at the men in my life, not one of them is rational, etc., etc. So this sense of if you're arguing that ideas can be tested publicly, in a strange way, that is both political, but it also opens up thought to everybody who can speak or who can represent themselves. The difficulty, of course, is how you get to represent yourself. How does a woman get to write for the Berliner Monatsschrift when women are not educated formally, or most women are not educated formally, or only the most elite women are educated formally? What happens if you're from, you know, if you're from a rural background, if you're a farmer, or you know, some kind of petty tradesman? Do you have a public voice? Can you speak? Can you speak in a way that would make sense? Or is your accent too untutored? For instance, notice that when you write, your accent doesn't come across. So writing suppresses accent. Then, in some sense, if you were to speak as somebody from North Germany, for instance, or from, and be viewed as being a dialectal, when you write German, so that your views are just taken as being German views. Anybody who can read German can evaluate them and can have an attitude towards them. That slogan, Sapere Aude, Dare to Know, that was adopted as a maxim in 1736 by the Society of the Friends of Truth, a reading circle in Germany with whose work Kant would have been familiar. What's at issue here in Kant's notion of Unmündigkeit, or of immaturity generally, is what Blake, in his great poem, contemporary poem, 1794, called Mind-Forged Manacles. If you look at the poem there that I gave you, Mind-Forged Manacles. Not the manacles that are slapped on you because you're black and a slave, but the manacles in some sense that are forging mental domination in some ways, mental inferiorization. Those people who allow themselves to be dominated by common sense in some sense, and that's what Kant opposes above all. So one more point, then I'll close. One could go on forever with this. But with respect to enlightenment, it seems, in Kant, thinking for oneself, when you think freely, when you think only to think, it seems to coincide with thinking aloud, which is a very peculiar notion. In other words, thinking for yourself doesn't stay here in your head. It gets publicized in these journals of opinions. It begins to take on a public presence. Not necessarily speaking aloud, but it's when these ideas are debated, contested in the public sphere. Somehow that's connected with the idea of what Kant calls free thought, or emancipated reason, is his term. So that there is a connection between subjectivity, being yourself in some ways, being mundig particularly, not unmundig, becoming a subject, knowing yourself, and having a social presence, a voice. That's where this debate gets particularly interesting. I'll stop at that point. Lots more to be said. We haven't touched on Foucault particularly yet. Tomorrow, let's start, if we can, with public and private, so that you actually know, do you understand implicitly what Kant means by these notions? Then we can consider what Foucault says is the way in which we might read Kant in 1984. Thank you. See you tomorrow.